Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. CEO of the Disney company, Michael Eisner, has gone from hero to alleged villain in a real-life story of big egos and clashing wills in the Magic Kingdom. Two Disney board members, including Walt Disney's nephew, Roy Disney, have resigned from the board, and they're calling for Eisner to get out of Disney's sprawling world. The company that first brought America Mickey Mouse has become a $25 billion media titan that owns ABC, ESPN, SoapNet, Japan Sports Channel, Rush Limbaugh's flagship radio station, Kentucky Prairie Farmer Magazine, and a list of other companies 6 pages long. Of course, there are the theme parks and Finding Nemo, but Disney is not following a storybook plot anymore. Senior executives are fleeing, Disney World attendance has dropped, and ABC is losing millions. Tonight on Point, Michael Eisner and his management of the Magic Kingdom. What happened to the fairy tale? Has Disney tried to spread the magic too thin? And are you still rooting for the wonderful world of Disney? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Los Angeles is Bruce Orwell, who covers Disney for The Wall Street Journal. Good evening and welcome, Bruce Orwell.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Bruce, what's going on with Disney? Why is Roy Disney in such a snit?
Well, his point of view is that he is a member of the Disney family, and the family deserves to have a place in the management of the company, and he does not feel like the company has been heeding what he and another board member who's affiliated with Mr. Disney, Stanley Gold, have had to say. They've had a number of criticisms of Michael Eisner's management and of the creative direction of the company, and for the time being, they have said that their criticisms from the inside are not being heard, so they need to take them outside and see if they can affect change that way.
So are you saying it's just about a kind of a clash of egos? I mean, it seems that the troubles run deeper than that. The Economist magazine says it's not the Magic Kingdom, it's the Tragic Kingdom, and the sort of big run-up they had in the 90s has been well done and gone for a while. What are they up against, apart from the kind of contest of wills?
Well, the company definitely has problems. From 1984, when Michael Eisner took over, until 1997 or so, this was nothing but a success story. Based on the renaissance of their animation movies, mm-hmm. based on rising theme park attendance and rising theme park prices, this was sort of a fairy tale story in corporate America. And Michael Eisner was considered a corporate superstar.
Revenues went from $1.5 billion to $22 billion. That's a pretty big jump.
It's a big jump, and you know, anybody who invested $1,000 in Disney in 1984, became a much wealthier person until the mid 90s. And they still would be, but since 1997, the growth has stopped. The stock prices bounced up and down, but mostly way down, and the earnings have fallen off.
So give us a sense, paint the Disney empire for us right now. I mean, it's all over the place, many different next-of-the-woods publishing, broadcast, cable, movies, music, theater, sports, financial, retail. What does it look like?
Well, the company is divided up into four main groups. One of them is the film studio, which of course makes animated movies and live action movies like Pirates of the Caribbean, but they also own the formerly independent film studio called Miramax in New York, which makes kind of edgier, smaller fare that people are familiar with around Oscar time. Then you have a big home video division, of course, which is within that part of the company that generates these days lots of money because DVDs are very popular and people love to get Finding Nemo DVDs and Pirates of the Caribbean DVDs and things like that. There's a television part of the company that is led by the ABC network, which they acquired in 1996 and has not done very well for them. They have been really unable to sustain any momentum in prime time at ABC, and the network has been a gigantic problem for them. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, in that same transaction, they also acquired 80% of ESPN, and that is a juggernaut and throws off a lot of cash, and it is the anchor of their cable operations. ESPN is now four sports channels, not just one, and has a lot of many devoted fans, and that generates a big cash flow. The Disney Channel as well in the broadcasting area. In the theme parks, they have expanded from just Disneyland and Walt Disney World to add new parks at each location and to open parks overseas, sometimes in licensing deals with other parties. So you now have four Disney parks in Orlando, two in Anaheim, California. You have two in outside of Paris, two in Tokyo, and one that is under construction in Hong Kong.
And how's attendance going at those?
Well, that for a long time was the strongest part of the company. It was, people loved the Disney parks. People still love the experience of watching their little kids gaze at Mickey Mouse in person for the first time. They made a lot of money from controlling the hotel space and what have you in Orlando particularly. Mm. But in the last couple of parks that they have opened have not been as successful. There's one in Anaheim called Disney's California Adventure, which has been a big bust since it opened in early 2001. The second gate that they just opened outside of Paris is also not doing very well. And there are some problems on that front.
They've been a juggernaut on Broadway, though. I don't know how much money that means for them, but they seem to have half taken over Broadway with The Lion King and the rest, and they've got some more big shows coming. Poppins, based on Mary Poppins, a Broadway production of Tarzan in 2005, The Little Mermaid 2007. I've even seen it written up, speculation that Disney might one day be all or most of Broadway.
Well, it would be hard. They certainly have become a dominant player on Broadway. That does not necessarily a gigantic driver of profit mm-hmm. in the company, but it is a prestige thing. When they started on Broadway, the idea, I think the first production was Beauty and the Beast, and it sort of seemed a little bit cheesy, like one of their theme park shows or something like that, mm-hmm. but they took a quantum leap forward in quality with the production of The Lion King, which has spawned different traveling productions all over the world. And Julie Taymor directed it, a very well-respected theater director, and that has won them acclaim for quality in that area. They now are, what they do is they open a production, hope that it takes hold in New York, and then start expanding it in touring productions that go all over the world. So I think at some points there have been like 20 different traveling productions of The Lion King or something like that. And obviously, if you can continue to keep those running and add a Mary Poppins a couple of years from now and add a Tarzan after that, you're going to have a big a big head of steam in that area. It's not the biggest profit driver.
But a big chunk of the American cultural scene there when they get to have that many shows going at once. Bruce, apart from the simple clash of wills element here, what are the divergent visions that are bringing this tension to the Disney board now? What's gone wrong here?
Well, the thing that Roy Disney has said publicly is that he thinks the company has fallen into the trap of being a quote-unquote soulless, rapacious media conglomerate that gives the perception to the public that it's just out for the quick buck. And I think that comes from just the overwhelming experience that people have when they go to the theme park and everything is branded with the name Disney and people are trying to sell you something everywhere. You know, you walk through the door to one of their character breakfasts where you are going to sit down with your kids and Donald Duck or Mickey Mouse will stop by your table and somebody comes with and takes a picture and then they try to sell you the picture. And it's that sort of endless merchandising of everything that I think he's referring to.
But was he griping when Disney was booming?
People like Roy Disney who own big stakes in companies don't make a lot of complaints when things are going well. And I think that when things started to go downhill a couple of 3 years ago, particularly after 9/11, which is really hurt the theme park business, particularly mm-hmm. with the travel downturn, it hurt their personal bottom line. They owned, still a 17 million shares of stock or something like that. And when the stock goes down from $40 to $15,
that hurts.
At some point, that hurts a little bit.
Yeah. Bruce Orwell, stand by. I want to welcome you to our conversation from Culver City, California, Kim Masters. She covers Hollywood for National Public Radio. She's a former Vanity Fair contributing editor, and she's the author of The Keys to the Kingdom, How Michael Eisner Lost His Grip. Good evening and welcome, Kim Masters.
Hi.
Hi. Kim, thanks for joining us. I wonder if you can take us a little deeper into this culture clash at Disney right now. Roy Disney hired Michael Eisner in the mid-'80s. What's gone wrong with this relationship?
Yeah, I find it's remarkable because, you know, Roy Disney did hire Michael Eisner, and Michael has sort of, Michael Eisner is no longer dancing with the one who brung him. I think that what really happened is that, to me, the pivotal year in all of this is 1994. Mm-hmm. There were 10 really great years, as Bruce referred to earlier. And in fairness, I would have to say that when Michael Eisner came to the Walt Disney Company, this was a big fallow. You know, this was actually more like a mine that had the mother lode that had not been touched. Mm-hmm. They had never even released one of the animated classics on home video. They were sort of paralyzed. And really, when Michael Eisner and his very important number two man, Frank Wells, arrived. Mm-hmm. Frank Wells said at one point that every time they opened a door, there was cash behind it. they boosted the profits of the company enormously just by doing very simple things like raising theme park prices. And they did revitalize, and in spite of themselves, animation. Michael Eisner initially came in, and he did not see really the value of animation at that point in the Walt Disney Company's history. They were working on the Black Cauldron, which was a sort of an ill-starred project. Mm-hmm. And his idea was, let's do it cheap and farm it out overseas. And Roy Disney is the one who was said, no, animation is really the guiding star of the Walt Disney Company, and you're not going to get rid of it so quickly.
So they had a good enough conversation between them at that point that Roy could make that point and Michael Eisner would pick it up, and obviously did run with it.
Michael Eisner spent years cultivating Roy Disney. This was the guy who brought him in. This was the Disney. This was Roy Disney. And for years, Michael made sure that Roy was very well taken care of.
So what's the heart of the burnout here? Why now? Just the loss in valuation, in capital, in Roy's account, or something else?
Well, I think it's a little more complicated than that. I think the company hasn't done well, which is the absolute heart of it. But I also think that since 1994, when Frank Wells, the number two man, was killed in a helicopter crash, Michael Eisner's been on his own. He does not listen to counsel. He's done things his own way in a very stubborn way that is not necessarily always constructive. And I think little by little, as that has had an ill effect on the company, as there's been huge creative turnover among the executives, something that Roy cited as he left, as Disney has been involved in sort of embarrassing public litigation and lost fairly consistently. I think Roy has become rather bitterly disenchanted and alienated from Michael, and vice versa.
Bruce, I know we just have you for another minute here. What's the word on the street in California? Who's the problem here? Is it Michael Eisner or is it Roy Disney?
Well, it's kind of a funny situation right now because both sides are kind of seem to be claiming victory, even though it's so personally bitter and it doesn't seem at all constructive. And in fact, seems very destructive.
But Eisner's still in the Disney castle, and Roy Disney is out.
He is, and I think that, you know, for the time being, it's going to stay that way. Whether or not Roy Disney can really orchestrate Michael Eisner's ouster is going to be a very long, slow process in which they have to generate a lot of public support for themselves and sort of light a prairie fire out there among us. Individual shareholders and people who love the brand and love the company, because so far the way Wall Street works, investors are kind of yawning at this a little bit. They don't really see that the big investors, I mean, don't really see that there is a clear prospect of change on the horizon. They might want that and think that that's a good thing, but it doesn't seem to be in the cards in the near term.
Though there is talk, we read, of Disney itself becoming a takeover target if it doesn't get its house in order. Bruce Orwell, I know we have to let you go. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Sure thing.
Bruce Orwell covers Disney for the Wall Street Journal. We're talking tonight about mayhem in the Magic Kingdom, trouble in Disneyland. You can join the conversation. What happened to the fairy tale? Has Disney tried to spread the magic too thin? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point.
Put on that grin and start right in to whistle loud and long. Just hum a merry tune. Just do your best and take a rest and sing yourself a song.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Mayhem in the Magic Kingdom, a kind of civil war in the heart of Disneyland, in the company that Walt Disney built. You can join the conversation tonight. Would Walt Disney recognize the giant that owns ABC, ESPN, the Mighty Ducks, and Miramax? Does Disney still have a grip on your cultural imagination? Do Finding Nemo and Disney World still trump The Simpsons and Nintendo? And are you rooting for Disney, the media megalith, or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from Culver City, California, by Kim Master. She's author of The Keys to the Kingdom, How Michael Eisner Lost His Grip. And with me in the studio now in Boston, Jay Lorish, professor of human relations at Harvard Business School, author of Back to the Drawing Board, Designing Boards for a Complex World. Good evening and welcome, Jay Lorish.
Thank you, Tom.
So we clearly have a little bit of a board problem here. You know a thing or two about boards, how boards work. How do you interpret what's going on at Disney? Roy Disney has resigned from the board. He's gone with his old friend Stanley Gold, and they've said, we're going to sit outside the Disney castle, and somehow we're going to take down Michael Eisner. How do you interpret all this, Jay Lorish?
Well, there's obviously the explanations that Kim and Bruce have put forward, but there's another aspect to this, which is the fact that the board, the Disney board has been in some degree of difficulty for some time and been criticized by institutional investors. They're involved now in a lawsuit in the state of Delaware on the with regard to the compensation that they approve for Orbitz. There's been a lot of criticism of them.
For Michael Eisner.
For Orbitz. Eisner raised the arranged the
Michael
compensation
Ovitz.
For Michael Orbitz.
Well, now, remind us Ovitz's role at Disney now?
I'm not sure what it was at the time.
Kim Masters, can you bring us up to date on that?
Yeah, there's been a longstanding succession issue, and for a short time, Michael Ovitz, who had been the dominant agent in Hollywood and supposedly
right.
Michael Eisner's best friend, mm-hmm. came in as the number two man, and that ended very badly when he was fired and paid out to the tune of a package that was then worth about $130 million.
So he was in and out, but you're saying, Jay Lorish, that whole compensation package raised eyebrows. What else? What other problems are there?
The problem was that the board apparently did not, at least the allegations are that the board really didn't discuss it, that Eisner did this on his own, and that the board did not exercise their duty of care in that decision. So there are shareholders suing that. The board's been criticized for Eisner's own compensation for years because of its size and because of the question, is it really related to performance? So there have been those things going on. They've tried to, there has been an attempt to reform the board. They brought in Senator Mitchell to be the presiding director. They brought in a lot of independent directors.
But there's been a charge that they're not really independent, that they have business ties to Disney.
That is true. I mean, there's all of that going on. That's my point. But at any rate, one of the things they did in this attempt to reform themselves to come back to Roy Disney was to set a retirement age for directors. And Disney has just reached that retirement age.
72.
72, and he has to leave. Now, if you're in his position with a lot of stock and a lot of commitment to the company and you're about to retire, maybe it's better to resign and use that as a way of beginning to put pressure on Eisner from the outside, because if you just resign, you sort of don't have the political clout you do if you say, if you just retire,
right.
You don't have the political clout. If you resign, you're making a statement.
So he's not going to fade away. He's going to sit outside
right.
with a catapult and launch some rocks in
right.
there.
Right. You know, General MacArthur said old soldiers just fade away, but apparently old Disneys don't do that. They're going to fight.
Not this one. Kim Masters, what exactly do you think Roy Disney is fighting four here, and doesn't he risk doing some damage to the castle while he shoots away at it?
I think he feels that, you know, he had no intention of retiring. He was being pushed out by Michael Eisner. One of the really artistic things that they've done at Disney is to take corporate governance issues. They have been criticized for their incredibly weak board and named the worst board for a couple of years running.
Ouch, that hurts.
And yes. And what they've done is they said, well, we're going to reform. And then they've crafted rules that somehow smite Michael Eisner's enemies. And when this retirement rule was passed, Roy Disney did not believe that it applied to him. And only found out after the fact that, by the way, this means you and we're kicking you out. He thought he was exempt as an executive, as vice chairman of the company.
Right.
So he didn't intend to retire. He didn't intend to resign. He was being thrown out. And now what he wants to do is have Michael Eisner thrown out. And yes, Tom, as you say, it could be damaging. But I think from Roy's point of view, what Michael Eisner doing is so damaging to the brand of Disney, to the business of Disney, that throwing him out is far healthier than letting him stay.
And how would he?
That's Roy's point of view.
How would he define that damage that he sees Michael Eisner doing when he gets all revved up and says, you know, Michael Eisner is soulless and rapacious and turning Disney into that? What exactly does he mean?
Well, he had a 7-point list in his letter of things that are, you know, from the incredible turnover among executives, and there is an army of people who were there and are not there now. And I think things like the endless litigation that they get into, where they, you know, are being sued by the Winnie the Pooh people, and they were sued by Jeffrey Katzenberg, and they were in just a constant stream. You know, there have been accidents at Disneyland. Roy obviously feels the maintenance of the theme parks is poor. I think he feels that across the board there's a sort of a penny-wise, pound-foolish philosophy that comes very much from Michael Eisner, whom Roy has criticized specifically for another one of his flaws that is frequently cited, which is micromanaging. So in this case, I think he feels that many, many times there are short-sighted decisions, such as the California Adventure theme park, which people just turned their noses up at. They thought it was extremely kind of thin on attractions and things to do, and that's why, as Bruce said, it was a flop. And again, across the board, this sort of penny-wise, pound-foolish management where a lot of times, I mean, I'll give you the biggest example and what I believe to be truly the sort of the cancer on Michael Eisner's presidency, which is the relationship with Pixar. You've mentioned Finding Nemo. Now, yeah. Disney has not done very successful homegrown animation at all in recent years, something I'm sure is very troublesome to Roy.
But Steve Jobs has at Pixar.
Absolutely. The big hits, Finding Nemo and Toy Story and Bug's Life, all of those have come out of Pixar. And that is a negotiation. That relationship is extremely sour between Steve Jobs at Pixar and Michael Eisner at Disney.
But Disney has rights to Pixar's output for a couple more years?
Well, that deal is running out, has to be renegotiated. And when I say has to be renegotiated, I don't think it's possible to overstate the critical importance of the Pixar deal to Disney right now. And Steve Jobs has made it clear that he's somewhat fed up with Disney. And again, penny-wise, pound-foolish. One of the big issues between them is that Pixar wanted to count a third Toy Story as part of its deal. And since it wasn't the actual letter of the deal, Michael Eisner said, no, it will not count. Now, obviously, a third Toy Story is a surefire blockbuster.
Right.
Obviously, with a partner like Pixar, it doesn't seem to be in the interest of Disney to play that kind of hardball. And that's exactly what they did. And I think they were gambling that maybe Finding Nemo would not perform as well as some of the other movies, because really it is impossible to sustain the kind of success that Pixar has sustained.
But it did.
I think they hoped, yeah, and it's the biggest animated movie of all time. So that was, if that's what they were hoping, and I think Disney was kind of hoping that Pixar would be weakened by a sort of a so-so performance. Instead, Pixar, there is no greater catbird seat than where Pixar sits right now with Disney. And when they come to renegotiate that deal, if Disney can't lose Pixar, they will have to make a deal that Steve Jobs will dictate to a large degree, and it will cost them hugely.
J. Lorsch, is this in some dimension a story as old as the fables that Disney made its fortune bringing to animation?
Well, there is a sort of a historical theme. I was thinking about it. It reminds me of Hewlett's attack on Fiorino at Hewlett Packard. I mean, there's this whole connection to the family.
Right.
We've seen great American companies. You often have a family founder, and the later generations of the family don't give up easily. And I think that's got to be, you know, part of what's going on here. There's certainly Roy Disney's investment. There's certainly his pride in wanting to stay in the company and stay on the board. But I think there's also this feeling that in some psychological sense, this is Disney's company. It was, you know, his uncle who founded it, and he wants to be sure that it doesn't lose its luster. And I think all of that is probably what's motivating him at this point to take a stand, to start a fight.
Is it possible to extend a brand and an operation to all the corners that Disney has extended to, so far from Mickey Mouse and animation, and keep that kind of core even family flame alive when it becomes this world-straddling conglomerate? Can that be done? Are there examples of it?
Well, I think that people believe that it's still theirs. I mean, don't you think the Ford family still believes the Ford company is theirs in some sense? I think that.
But they've got a Ford running it now.
Well, that's true. You never know what's going to happen to these things. I don't think there's a young Disney in the wings, but the point I'm trying to make is that the psychology of these families is that, you know, the public puts their capital in, the public gets a return, but somehow the family still has an important stake in this thing. And I think that in one sense it's possible that you get to understand Roy Disney, you got to understand that aspect of it as well.
Kim Masters, is it possible that that's an even stronger sentiment in this case where, if you think about it, it's kind of incredible what's been built out of just the sort of romantic magic of little animated figures? I mean, that was a very personal perspective on the world that Walt Disney brought, and you can imagine people circling around it and saying, that's the precious flame at the heart of this. We don't just want to be another media company.
Yes, I think that's critical for Disney. Disney is unique in the entertainment world in that it is a brand. And people don't say, I think I'll go see a Paramount movie this weekend, or I'll go see a Universal film this weekend. But a Disney film, Disney still means something. It's the only one. And therefore, I think that the keeping of that particular flame is a critical part of the job of whoever runs the Walt Disney Company. And I'll tell you, I mean, I do think that maybe Roy Disney feels some proprietary interest, and I think he feels that he just deserves a certain amount of regard as the as the nephew of Walt and so on and so forth. But I also think he's shown in the past he's a very practical businessman. And I think that, you know, it is critical in his mind that whoever runs the Walt Disney Company, however big it gets, has to maintain that image, that it's the home of Mickey and that it's the happiest place on earth and it's not this ruthless hardball-playing corporation.
There's been a lot of coin minted off of that image. We have a lot of callers who want to join us. Let's turn to them. Keith is calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Keith. You're on the air.
Hi. At first, I thought I was going to call up with this, and I usually like to have something a little deep when I call into these things, but your lead in into my call kind of, I guess, makes this appropriate. You know, you look at Walt Disney, who came up with this company, and here was a guy who was into the fantasy thing. I mean, you know, of course, he ran this big enterprise, but he'd come out and he'd do his appearances at the park, and I remember he used to do the television show week after week. And
sure, with that little mustache, and he started out actually drawing Mickey. I mean, as simple as that.
He voiced Mickey, too. And then I remember after he died and they brought The Wonderful World of Disney back on TV, they had Michael Eisner do it. And here this guy comes off looking like this corporate lug. You know, and you see him on with Goofy, and it looks like he's doing a performance review with Goofy, not doing the patter that Walt did. And it just seems to me like that he was just totally inappropriate to run this company.
Well, inappropriate, but Keith, he took this country from a company from a valuation of something like $2 billion to $67 billion. He made a boatload of money for Disney investors.
Up it goes and down it goes.
it does go up and it does go down. Keith, thanks for calling. John's calling from Belmont, Massachusetts. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say that, in my opinion, I think that not only Disney is losing economic value, but it's also losing popularity because, I mean, my uncle lived in New York City for, I don't know, 10 years.
Okay.
And he never heard a positive word about Disney or Mickey Mouse.
Well, where was he hanging out? With a pretty tough crowd, I guess.
Yeah, he was. So he ended up doing this movie where he put Mickey Mouse on a breadboard.
Oh, no. I don't want to know what comes next, John.
And he had it look like a magic carpet.
Yeah.
And he set Mickey Mouse on fire, and he played the I Can Show You the World song.
Ouch. John, how old are you?
I'm 11.
And how big a part of your world are Disney products, Disney characters, Disney movies? Do you like them?
Well, I have to say, I watched Finding Nemo, and I caught a little bit of Pirates of the Caribbean, but that's really all I've watched in a long time in relation to Disney.
So what does it compete with in your media world as an 11-year-old?
Well, we don't have a TV at my house. My mom doesn't believe in it.
Well, geez, well, you're kind of cut off from an awful lot of Disney right there.
Yeah, I don't get much. I mean, I do watch ABC sometimes.
How do you do that?
My babysitter sometimes lets me watch TV.
Oh, those babysitters. They break all the rules. But what do you think? Are you ready to invest in Disney for the next 10 years, John, or not?
No, definitely not.
All right. Thanks for the analysis. It sounds like you've got a career in it there. Thanks for your call, John. Lynn's calling from Cohasset, Massachusetts. Hi, Lynn. You're on the air.
Hi. I really bring a sort of long perspective to Disney World. My husband and I first visited Disney World in 1974, very soon after it opened. Really enjoyed it a lot. We made many visits to Disney World with our children.
Okay.
We wouldn't go for like a week to Disney, but if we were in Florida, we'd stop by for a day or two and see the parks. And we watched a real change occur.
What was the change, Lynn?
Parks. When we first visited Disney World, you would pay a certain amount of money, and you would then be given a little book of tickets, and you'd do 2E attractions,
okay.
2D attractions,
yeah,
and
yeah.
so on. And you sort of paced yourself through the day. They then changed the whole format. They upped the prices considerably, and everything was totally uncontrolled. You could visit as many attractions as you liked.
So what's the problem? Just the higher price?
No, it created a really frenetic atmosphere. It was a frenetic atmosphere that didn't exist before because you knew that you were sort of pacing yourself through the day. Now there's this sort of attitude, we've got to do as much as we possibly can. We've got to get on as many rides.
We've paid for all this, and by golly, we've got to make use
absolutely,
of it.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So are you still going, Lynn, or are you checked out?
We haven't gone for a couple of years, 2 or 3 years. We had a really nasty experience there 1 year on New Year's Eve. Went with our teenagers, thought it would be fun to be there. They had let an incredible number of people into the park, so many that you literally could not walk along the street or the sidewalk.
Yeah, I have to say, I've seen that as well, and nobody wants to go to Disney World for a nasty experience. But Lynn, thanks for your call. Kim Masters, what about the theme parks themselves? Wasn't there actually a death at Disney World recently on one of their rides?
There was, and I think that there was another previous one a few years back, and the question is going to be, how have those parks been maintained? And if, in fact, what Roy Disney is alleging is true, that the maintenance is not that good, and there may be some evidence to suggest that, you know, that's going to be another large check.
And he didn't say not that good. He said sickening. Roy Disney's word.
Okay, sickening.
Yeah.
Well, yes. And if that's true, I mean, you know, a lawsuit like that isn't going to affect the Disney bottom line. But I think, obviously, you know, you don't want people thinking that they're going to either be crushed by the crowd. Again, to me, that speaks to this concept of being penny wise and pound foolish. Pack them in, and then people will say, you know, I don't really want to go back there.
How important a part of the Disney revenue stream are the theme parks, the big parks?
They're very important. I mean, the animation, I think, is a particular issue because the animation division drives so many other sections. The characters appear in the theme parks. The consumer products are, you know, the Little Mermaid nightgowns and pajamas and things like that. So animation has been an engine that really drives the company. And I would think that, you know, you could sort of shrug a little bit with the theme parks and say, well, there was 9/11, you know, there were other reasons. I mean, to some degree, I felt that Michael Eisner has perversely benefited in the past couple of years because things like 9/11 may have helped to mask fundamental management problems that people could attribute difficulty at Disney to, you know, oh, the tourism's off.
Lay it off
or,
on 9/11
ABC,
and the fear of terror.
You know, at ABC, well, advertising rates have gone down,
right.
You know, and then the
right.
fact that their programming is terrible and that they don't have any hits becomes less sort of front and center, although everybody's obviously aware of that.
Leaves you wondering if Pixar might one day come back to supplant Disney. Kim Masters, J. Lord, stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight about mayhem in the Magic Kingdom. Is it time to get the last Disney out of the business or time for Michael Eisner to go? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
And you wish upon a star makes no difference.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a kind of civil war in the company that Walt Disney built, a little mayhem in the Magic Kingdom. You can join the conversation. What's happened to the fairy tale? Does Disney still have a grip on your cultural imagination? And are you rooting for Disney, the media megalith, or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight in the studio by Jay Loris, professor of human relations at Harvard Business School and author of Back to the Drawing Board, Designing Boards for a Complex World, and from Culver City, California by Kim Masters, author of The Keys to the Kingdom, How Michael Eisner Lost His Grip. We're joined right now from Whitewater, Wisconsin by Andrew. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Yes, good evening. I can't express how much mixed feelings I have. I'm a lifelong Disney fan. I'm going down in about 6 weeks for my annual vacation with my family down to Disney World.
Annual, so you're a true believer.
Absolutely. I sold my stock yesterday.
Whoops.
I had to. As a business decision, no good can come of this.
No good can come of the fist fight going on between Roy Disney and Michael Eisner.
Yeah.
I mean, the stock
exactly.
is what? It's been trading at around $23 or something like that, up what, 40% or something this year. That looks pretty good,
Andrew. I made a little bit of money.
Or made it back. I mean, it's still well below where it used to be.
Yes, but I bought it on the rebound. But that's the point is, I think that Jay Lorsch really began to hit the nail on the head. Of course, he's Jay Lorsch. He would. Yes, it's a publicly traded company, but when the company has the family name on it and there's a family member on the board, it operates a little bit differently. And when that individual makes these kind of statements and does these kind of actions, in the short run, no good can come of it.
So as much as you love it, you're selling the stock. You sold it today. Jay Lorsch, what's the solution then to a situation like this? Does Michael Eisner have to go? I don't know if there's another Disney in the wings. I haven't heard of one. Where does it go from here?
Well, I think where it goes from here is that the board, at the end of the day, this board, which has been so criticized, is going to have to make a decision. At the moment, from what we can see from the outside, they seem to be supporting Eisner's still. But so I think that what Roy Disney could do is get shareholders and others to put pressure on the directors and then get the directors to say we've had enough of Eisner. So I think where it's going to go and where the battle is going to be fought is, first of all, for the minds of the shareholders and maybe the public a little bit. And, you know, we'll create a media frenzy around this thing. But at the end of the day, the question is, can Eisner hold on to the directors? And so far, mm-hmm. he seems to have their loyalty.
Roy says the directors are kind of bought and paid for by Eisner one way and another.
That's exactly what he says. And yet, you know, trying to be fair and objective about the whole thing, there's some people on that board now who do seem to have, at least as we would look at it from the outside, pretty good integrity. George Mitchell, the former senator from mm-hmm. Maine, for example, I'm not sure whether he could be bought or not. I'd like to think that he couldn't be bought. Mm-hmm. But, you know, certainly prior to this and in the former incarnations of this board, there were people that were really bought. I mean, at one point we had his children's kindergarten teacher on the board. We had his,
Michael Eisner's children's kindergarten
right,
teacher.
We had his personal lawyer was chairman of the Compensation Committee. That's the kind of thing that was going on.
That works pretty well for a CEO.
Well, it does. But, you know, out of fairness, Roy Disney was there, and he was allowing that to happen as well.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
I mean, this board was really, maybe it really had a lot of sickness in it. And I think they at least say they are trying to fix it. And they've got some people there, I think, who have reputations that are at stake here. And I would assume they would want to, you know, do what we would expect good directors to do. So I think that if Roy Disney can make the case and can get shareholders agitated, we may see the board having to rethink its relationship with Eisner. But Eisner's been a very clever guy. He keeps bouncing back.
And he has said, you know, I win in the ninth inning. Kim Masters, what's the betting out there? Is there a strategy by which people really see how Roy Disney can boot Eisner out?
No, I think it's considered to be quite an uphill battle because the stock is scattered all over the place. I mean, back in the day, the stock was kind of, concentrated a bit more in the Bass Brothers and Warren Buffett and people and some big institutional holders. Now it's it's harder to recruit a few people who can make serious trouble. And the huge question with Disney has always been, who would take the job if they got rid of Michael Eisner?
Is there a white knight? Is there a beauty for this beast out there?
You know, there is nothing in the obvious right now. People kick around some names, Peter Chernin, who works for Rupert Murdoch now, or maybe some people have kicked around the idea of Steve Jobs taking the whole thing over. But I don't think there's a big consensus behind anybody. And I don't think, that there's an obvious person, company that's going to run in there and take it over at this point. So I think for the time being, I don't see change coming.
Steve Jobs, now there's a thought. I mean, he's a guy who's got some of that Disney-style magic around him one way or another. Is that a serious notion, Kim Masters?
Well, it's something that Steve Jobs has sort of played with when he talks to analysts. He sort of says, oh, well, maybe we'll buy Disney. I mean, you could sort of play this parlor game and say, well, what if Paul Allen and the guys at DreamWorks teamed up with this guy? You know, it's kind of like some sort of fantasy football or rotisserie thing where you sort of try to figure out who would band together. But it just doesn't seem very practically possible. And there's a lot of people, some people don't like Steve Jobs. I talked to a very influential money wielder in Hollywood just a couple days ago, and he said, I think Steve Jobs is as difficult as Michael Eisner. So, there's all sorts of not, you know, reasons why that might not work. And some people say that Steve Jobs wouldn't do it if he had the opportunity because it's just too much of a hassle.
You get the keys to the Magic Kingdom and you never know how it's going to affect your personality.
Exactly.
David's calling from Weston, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I just wanted to get some reaction from your guests about the longtime criticism from people like satirist Carl Hiaasen and others who've pointed out that Mickey may be the public face of Disney, but at the heart of it, there really is a conglomerate and a corporation there that may not necessarily play nice.
We'll pick it up. Jay Lorsch, I mean, lots of companies have brand images, and lots of companies are simultaneously corporations. Does it ultimately bleed through if a corporation walks away from some genuine connection to its brand identity? Does it ultimately look like a betrayal?
Well, I think if it does it for a long time, it may be. But I think that at the end of the day, this is a corporation, and its purpose is not only to serve its customers, but to make money for its shareholders. And the image that's out there is really the I suppose, in a sense, is the core asset. You know, as Kim was saying before, one of the parts of their strategy that's made the whole thing work is the animation stuff, which they can then play out at the theme parks and
products. A thousand different ways, and they can pull that image over the rest of their operation.
So that Mickey, to the extent that he's sort of the central character or the original character in all this animation, is certainly critically important. But it is a corporation.
So there's a balance there. You can mooch off that for a while, but take it too far, and the connection erodes.
If you damage it, you're really damaging your primary asset. And if you get, I mean, it would seem to me that this constant criticism, if it goes on for too much longer, it will continue to damage that image.
Jeanette's calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Jeanette. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm just calling because as a child, you know, Disney is sort of the childhood mecca. You know,
I'm
in my late 20s, and I really grew up with the whole world of Disney and just at the tail end of the Walt Disney era. And I now work with children for a living, and I've watched Disney become this soulless beast that is all about merchandising. And
is it that is it that obvious to you?
Is
it
is they can make for him?
Is it that clear to you, Jeanette? Is it that obvious? Is it that clear to you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it has the way they market to children is really disgusting.
Well, they really go after it. Our time is short, but Jeanette, thanks for your call. Kim Masters, it sounds like a little brand erosion right there. very quickly, Walt Disney is frozen somewhere, right?
I don't know if that's true.
Is that just
no
an urban
idea.
Legend? I thought he was.
I really don't.
I think he is in one of these cryogenic chambers somewhere. Who knows? Maybe the man will have to come back and take care of business himself one day. But in the meantime, Michael Eisner digging in Roy Disney on the outside. Have you seen how he's begun to circle his troops in an effort to push Michael out?
Roy Disney, I think, is going to be meeting with a number of influential investors and talking to a lot of press people and doing what he can. And I don't know, you know, the thing about Wall Street now is I don't think Wall Street is taking a long view. They like, you know, for the last few minutes, the stock has perked up a bit. Right. And unless if it dips back down again, Wall Street will turn. And if it doesn't, they'll say, well, things are okay.
And what about the folks around Michael Eisner? Is there still a brain drain going on, or has he got a team that's going to stick with him now?
I have to say, when I wrote my book, one of the things that struck me is that pretty much every major relationship that Michael had in business ended with a pretty spectacular rupture. And, you get to a point with him where he either decides that you're stupid or that you've betrayed him or both. And I think it's pretty hard to be a long-term survivor. There are one or two, but, boy, are there legions who have gone.
Well, he may be sitting alone with Mickey at the end of the day. Kim Masters, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Kim Masters covers Hollywood for National Public Radio. She's author of The Keys to the Kingdom. And Jay Lorsch, it's been great having you. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me, Tom.
Jay Lorsch, professor of human relations at Harvard Business School, author of Back to the Drawing Board. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, Elvis suits back in the building. This is On Point. Elvis Presley became an icon of rebellious cool by putting a Southern white boy's spin on African-American rhythm and blues, but his early rock and roll style also adopted from black Memphis in the 1950s. The Graceland Estate recently released thousands of outfits that have been sitting in storage since Presley's death in 1977. The clothing that stamped Elvis's image is now on public view and the subject of a new book, Elvis Fashion, from Memphis to Vegas. Long before the sequined jumpsuits of his later years, Elvis cultivated the look that many Americans prefer to remember him by at Lansky Brothers Haberdashery in Memphis. In this radio diary, Bernard Lansky talks about meeting Elvis and the ride his business took on Presley's gold lamé coattails.
Well, it's one for the money, two for the show, three to get ready, now go, cat, go.
I started out with Elvis years ago. We had a void in the market in Memphis for high fashion merchandise. And we were on a famous Beale Street years ago. We had all ethnic business. And we went into real high-class merchandise. And we had a lot of singers and things from recording companies here, a lot of ethnic customers. And Elvis used to work at the Lowe's Theater. He used to come around and look in our windows and walk up and down Beale Street, see what's happening. It happened one day, I happened to see this young man standing out in front of the store, and I invited him in. And he told me what his name was, and, you know, at that time it didn't mean anything. He's a new kid on the block. So I showed him around. He said, "Boy, this is sharp, real sharp. I don't have no money." He said, "But when I get rich, I'm going to buy you out." I said, "Do me a favor. Don't buy me out. Just buy from me." So he walked out, and the next Friday he got paid, and he came in and bought a shirt, a $3.95 shirt. Man, that was a lot of money, man, that time. So he started coming back in the store and buying stuff. And all at once, he came in one day and told me, Mr. Lance, he said, "I've got a contract to go to New York. So I'm going to play on television." I said, "Man, that's real cool." He said, "I've got to have some merchandise." I said, "No problem." So I started fixing up some outfits for him, some real sharp clothing, different things, you know, make him look good on television. So anyway, he said, "I don't have no money." I said, "Well, that's no problem. I said, we can sponsor you." So we got him dressed up and everything. That Saturday night, he was on television. Man, unreal. That's when it was black and white. Wasn't it color television?
That big eight wheeler rolling down the track, and your true loving daddy ain't coming back.
We started him out in the pink and black. That's when that's still the big number. When he graduated from high school, we put his former tuxedo on for junior senior prom with the peg leg pants and the no back pockets, inverted pleats. We had pick-stitch shirts and coats, all western pocket front. We go with the high fashion and the mohair. And, you know, we kind of winged him off at him, and, you know, what he would look much better in.
I had to leave town for a little while.
A lot of people come in the store, man, well, I want whatever it's called. I want the same thing he's got. He was a PR man for our clothing. And it's all ethnic street. We getting all these white dudes down there, and the black guys that come in there and buy them. We get them all fixed up.
Baby, baby.
I was laying it out because no one else had it. I mean, we're the only one had it. We go to the market, and people thought we were crazy. That's what the people are asking for. It's something different. They want something that no one else has got, and they knew where it come from. We had them coming in from all over. We were working mostly in the black and the ethnic. B.B. King used to come in the store. We had Bobby Blue Bland. You name it, we had them all. All of them used to come in. The clothing to the king. Man, after I got him straightened up, everything was fantastic. Clothes made him. That's what made him. When he come out with something new, man, ooh, man, that's dynamite. There's something sharp, man. You cool, man. All in, you know, put that jive talk and all that on him and everything. And it kept on coming in. I said, "Well, if it ain't broke, don't fix it."
Why can't you see what you're doing to me when you don't believe a word I say?
Bernard Lansky is 77. He put the shirt on Elvis's back. He's been selling men's clothes at Lansky Brothers in Memphis since 1946. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.